controversies around removing the 45% income tax rate, possibly cutting benefits in real terms, and a little bit of market turbulence as a result. This week, the Prime Minister told us her priorities, and I'm not going to try and do an impression, but growth, growth, growth. I don't know whether you're the kind of person who avoids sort of economic topics or whether you've been fixated on your mortgage rate over the last week or so, but I want to suggest that Christians really do need to think about money and to think about poverty, because the Bible talks about it frequently. Was it 2 weeks ago on Sunday morning, the Lord Jesus there with this rich man? Go, sell everything you have and give to the poor. Or you think of the Apostle Paul. Apostle Paul, great missionary, spreading the gospel around the world. But it's interesting to notice that he spends quite a significant amount of time arranging a collection for the poor believers in Jerusalem. Indeed, actually, when the early Christians meet the Apostle Paul, one of the things they remind him to do, and which he's willing to do according to Galatians, is have a concern for the poor. Poverty is a big issue both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. Those who know me well will know that I spent quite a lot of time traveling around the country talking about sexuality. This time yesterday was in Glasgow, so if I look slightly sort of stunned, I don't quite know where I am. But one of the dangers, I think, as I reflect on talking about sexuality lots, is the danger that holiness and godliness can just be limited to that area of life. Whereas the Bible will say at least as much about our attitude to money, finance, those in need, and so on. What we're going to look at matters if we're going to live in a way that pleases the Lord. So let's go to the edge of the Promised Land. If you've been in the Deuteronomy series at all, you'll be aware of the context. The people have been traveling through the wilderness. They've not really had very much. And now they're about to go into the Promised Land, a land that is flowing with milk and honey, a land of great prosperity. And throughout Deuteronomy, Moses is telling the people, this is how you're to conduct yourself when you're there. And I say, last week, we considered how they were going to worship in the Promised Land. Here we're going to think about how do they sort out their economics when they're in the Promised Land. Now, it is going to be complex for us, because you're not going to be able to go straight across from Israel in the Promised Land to an exact equivalent today. Because Israel in the Promised Land was basically a state made up entirely of God's people. A state made up of God's people. Now, the UK is a state. You might have noticed it's not entirely made up of the people of God. The church, we are the people of God. But we haven't got a prime minister. A pastor isn't a prime minister. There's not an exact equivalent there. And so we're going to need to do a little bit of work. I think primarily we're going to see implications for the church, although unusually for me, we are going to do a bit of politics today, because there are some implications, I think, for the state. But let me start with the conundrum and just say halfway through, I'm going to get you to talk to each other, partly to discuss it, partly to wake you up. So let's look at the conundrum that lies at the heart of the passage. You might have noticed it as Keith was reading it. They're about to head into the Promised Land, and Moses says, there need be no poor people among you. Actually, literally, there will be no poor people among you, is what the text says. And so there's this expectation they're going to get into the Promised Land, and God is going to supply all their needs. That's the point of the Promised Land. It's a place rich in provision from God. And if the people stay faithful to him, he will richly supply all their needs. There should be no poverty in the Promised Land. And yet, of course, the reality is going to be different. As you get verse 7, if anyone is poor among your fellow Israelites, at verse 11, there will always be poor people in the land. And interestingly, Jesus actually quotes Deuteronomy 15, verse 11, when it's in the night week before he dies. He says, the poor you will always have with you. And so you get these two things. There shouldn't be poor people, and yet there always will be. That's within the promised land. And it's probably true of society more generally. You know, in the Garden of Eden, there is no need for poverty. There's no poverty in paradise. A God who provides us with a world where we have what we need. And yet the reality of human sin is such that won't always be the case. Now, whether that's the sin in the promised land, they disobey God, and so as God's judgment on them, they don't enjoy all the blessings of the promised land. That's partly the case. Partly also the case that inequality and the pursuit of wealth amongst those who are rich without a concern for those in need will also mean there'll be poverty. You have this sense there shouldn't be poverty, and yet, tragically, because of human sin, there will be. Back in 2005, you had the campaign Make Poverty History. And in the end, I did think the title was somewhat optimistic. Because it seems to me, according to Deuteronomy 15, and according to Jesus, for as long as there is going to be human sin, there will be poverty. That's not to say necessarily the poverty is the case of those who are, the fault of those who are poor, although sometimes it's the case that poverty results from bad decisions. As often, it's the case that actually a commitment to inequality, a commitment to furthering people's own needs rather than having a concern for their fellow human beings, means that poverty will be an ongoing reality. Human beings can't make poverty history. It's actually only when the Lord Jesus returns, when we are restored to the ultimate promised land, that there will be no poor people amongst us. You will always have the poor with you, Jesus says. But notice, that isn't, well, you've always got poor people with you, so let's just shrug our shoulders and say, well, you know, nothing we can do about it. That isn't the way the text works. Do you notice? Verse 11, there will always be poor people in the land, so it doesn't go on, so shrug your shoulders, there's nothing you can do about it. Therefore, I command you to be open-handed towards your fellow Israelites who are poor and needy in the land. So if that's the conundrum, what you see next is a call to generosity. You may not be able to make poverty history, it will always exist, but there is stuff you can do about it. We saw a hint of the generosity at the end of chapter 14, which we looked at last week, where as part of the worship of God's people, as they gather in Jerusalem, there to bring their tithes. And the tithes were for two reasons, partly to subsidize the Levites, the priests who were running the worship, but also the end of chapter 14, bring your tithes, so that there's things for the foreigners, the fatherless, the widows, which becomes a kind of Old Testament triumvirate of need. Those coming from other countries, those widowed, orphans with nobody to provide for them, you are to bring your tithes so that there will be provision for such people. And then in chapter 15, you're into the issue of debt. So somebody is poor, they're in debt, they can't pay their bills, they've got no food to eat. How are debts to be handled? Well, the headline is verse 1, chapter 15, if you've got that in front of you. At the end of every 7 years, you must cancel debts. And so within the sort of Jewish calendar, as it were, you had every 7 years marked off. This is the year where debts have to be cancelled. That was what Moses was saying Jewish economics should look like. Every 7 years, debts are to be cancelled. It was part about giving people dignity, that people's whole life was not to be consumed with debt. There was the opportunity for them to be free. This is how it's to be done, verse 2. Every creditor shall cancel any loan they have made to a fellow Israelite. They shall not require payment from anyone among their own people because the Lord's time for cancelling debts has been proclaimed. So-and-so, they're in debt, I don't know, 500 quid. Ah, it's the seventh year. You're no longer in debt. Simply how it works. Seventh year, debts had to be written off. Now, if you think about it, and this is probably why you can't just translate this across the UK, there is a potential problem with this, isn't there? It's year six. Year six, this person is poor. They want alone. And you're kind of thinking to yourself, well, who on earth is going to be mad enough to loan me any money in year six? Yeah, they know how it works. I'm going to ask them for 500 quid this year, and they know next year it's just going to be written off. How's that supposed to work? You can see the issue. And yet, it's astonishing. Did you notice it as you work your way through Deuteronomy 15? If anyone, verse 7, is poor among your fellow Israelites, in any of the towns of the land that the Lord your God has given you, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted towards them. Be open-handed and freely lend them whatever they need. Be careful not to harbor this wicked thought. The seventh year, the year for cancelling debts, is near, so that you do not show ill will towards the needy among your fellow Israelites and give them nothing. You see what he's saying? It's year six. Can I have £500, please? And you're kind of thinking to yourself, gosh, really, I'm giving him 500 quid when it's going to be written off next year? And God is saying, don't think like that. It's remarkable, isn't it? Don't think like that. Don't think what's in it for me. That's an irrelevant thought, what's in it for me. The key thought is, how can I be as generous as possible? The very reasonable thought, surely if I just lend this money, I'm not going to get anything back because it's the next year when it is cancelled. Don't have that reasonable thought. Rather, have the generous thought. Be as open as I can. And if I end up losing out because of it, well, that's not an issue, is it? Because rather, I'm going to be open-handed and generous. That's the emphasis all the way through. It's not thinking, is this reasonable for me? Is this good for me? But rather, that person is in poverty, that person is in need, and so I'm going to be as generous as I can be towards them. Just notice the language that runs all the way through it. Verse 10, give generously. Verse 11, I command you to be open-handed towards your fellow Israelites who are poor and needy. And in case you think this sort of missing out is just limited to this, it's worth noticing in chapter 23, we're told what the interest rate you're allowed to charge is. It's 0%. You cannot charge interest on any money that you're going to loan to a fellow Israelite. Somebody who's looking for a mortgage in the near future. I'm quite keen on this sort of applying across. But nevertheless, you see the point. Within God's people, there is to be this utter generosity. Now, before I get you to do a bit of talking together, let me just mention the end, second half of verse 15, where you get this issue of freeing servants. Now, I'm aware that even the very name here has got alarm bells ringing. Servants, slaves, what on earth is this doing in the Bible? What happened in Israelite society was that people who were in desperate need, one of the ways they could deal with their debts was, if you like, by selling themselves into servanthood. So again, we're thinking something totally different to the hideous evil of a slave trade back in the 18th century, where people were literally kidnapped, transported across the world, appallingly treated. That isn't the situation here. It's part of the way in which the economy was to work, was people in desperate need could sell themselves into a family where, of course, they ended up then being provided for in a way which wouldn't necessarily have been the case should they have stayed on their own. They're provided for with the aim that they're treated well and they pay off their debt by working. And sometimes the closeness of that relationship that is built as they provide for their servants is such that often it was the case that people wanted to stay. And you get the details that in verse 16 onwards, you know, if you want to stay with this family that you're serving, well, here's the procedure for doing that. But if that wasn't the case, notice again, there's a definite term limit applied. You can't have somebody in this position of servanthood for any longer than 6 years. On the seventh year, they are to be set free. And when you do set them free, verse 13, when you release them, don't send them away empty-handed. Sounds like a game show, doesn't it? Sorry, don't send them away empty-handed. Supply them liberally from your flock, your threshing floor, and your winepress. Give to them as the Lord your God has blessed you. And so did you notice all the way through this passage, just the recurring ideas? Generosity, open-handed. Supply them liberally. Don't harbor the thought, what do I get out of this? Just an utter giving of themselves and giving of their finance away in terms of generosity. Now, just for 5 or 6 minutes, when we talk to people near you, and I'm aware you might not know the people near you, so do feel free to say hello and introduce yourself, but a couple of questions. What might this look like in practice for us? So my guess is most of us haven't got servants, and it might be we haven't got people in debt to us, but what might be examples of this sort of generosity for us? And any implications for society? As I say, it's unlikely we're going to go straight across to all mortgages should be written off after 6 years, tempting as that would be. What might be possible implications for society? Happy? I know they're not easy questions, but see what you can manage for about 5 or 6 minutes. Go for it. People. Well, I hope you've enjoyed putting the world to rights. I'm going to reflect on those questions a little bit in a moment, but let me just pick up a few more passages in this section beyond chapter 15. Do you want to flick forward to chapter 24 and verses 10 to 13? And again, it picks up this issue of giving a loan. When you make a loan of any kind to your neighbor, don't go into their house to get what is offered to you as a pledge. Stay outside and let the neighbor to whom you're making the loan bring the pledge out to you. If the neighbor is poor, do not go to sleep with their pledge in your possession. Return their cloak by sunset so that your neighbor may sleep in it. Then they will thank you and it will be regarded as a righteous act in the sight of the Lord your God. What happened when loans were offered was that people did give something as a sort of guarantee, as it were, that the loan would be paid back. But you notice just the dignity here. Don't go into the house to take it yourself. You know, wait for them to bring it out to you. And I think that's just about giving dignity to the poor person. You know, you're not to act as the bailiff. And if the pledge was, I don't know, say a fine piece of clothing that kept them warm at night, yeah, make sure you keep giving it back to them each night. And again, it's just about giving dignity and respect to this person who's fallen into poverty. Or consider the last part, chapter 24, verses 19 to 22. Gives another example of how this kind of thing is to work. When you're harvesting in your field and you overlook a sheaf, don't go back to get it. Leave it for the foreigner, the fatherless, the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat the olives from your trees, don't go over the branches a second time. Leave what remains for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. When you harvest the grapes in your vineyard, don't go over the vines again. Leave what remains for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. So here you've got a farmer, and they're sort of getting the corn from the field and they miss a bit. What do you do? Go back and get it in? No, leave it. Leave it so that the person in need has got something that they can pick. Or the olives in the trees. Olives are repulsive, so frankly, leave the olives in the trees. But if you do have to get the olives out the trees, then, you know, again, leave some. You know, leave some so that there's stuff that those in need can eat. Likewise with the grapes in the vineyard. Do you see how this is consistent with the general thrust? Don't get everything you can for yourself. Don't get all the corn, all the olives, all the grapes. Don't get it all for yourself. There's another priority, the priority of those in need. Now, what are the implications of some of this? Let me talk a little bit about society. It's worth saying government is really complex. You know, it's easy, isn't it, to take pot shots at governments, perhaps particularly in the last couple of weeks. But in a sense, I'm aware it's very easy to say government should do more of X, Y, Z, whatever our pet thing is, without actually raising awkward questions like where the money comes from. Government is complex, and so sort of cheap things, oh, the government should do more, is an easy comment to make. It's sometimes harder in reality. And so I don't think you can go straight from here in Deuteronomy to a modern society. It is more complex than that. One of the things we will notice, though, over the next two or three weeks is it's quite hard to categorize the Bible as either left-wing or right-wing. This will have sounded quite left-wing today. Just wait for the session on justice in a few weeks' time, which might sound like the opposite. It's also worth saying, outside of Deuteronomy, the Bible does commend work. I mean, the New Testament gets pretty blunt. If you don't work, you shouldn't eat. And that isn't speaking to those who, for reasons of physical illness and so on, can't work. That isn't speaking to that. Rather, it is saying, actually, if as human beings we've got the ability to work, we should do. And so it doesn't seem to me wrong that government should be encouraging people where they are physically able to do so to work. That seems eminently reasonable to me. But having said that, you do get a sense that a state that is operating in line with the priorities of God, where people are treated with dignity as those who are made in God's image, it is right for society to have a concern for the poor and a concern for those in need. And that does seem to me to apply to secular societies as well. It's a fascinating section in the end of Proverbs, Proverbs 31, where you have the six sayings of King Lemuel, who's reporting the advice of his mother. No idea who these people are, but his mother tells this king, speak up for the rights of all who are destitute. Defend the rights of the poor and the needy. Now, of course, you can have debates as to how that should work, but it does seem to me, actually, a welfare state is a remarkable thing that does reflect our Judeo-Christian heritage as a country. Again, it's not always been the case down through history that there has been a welfare state. It is something that I think we should celebrate as one of the privileges of living in a country here, where there is at least within pretty much every politician a sense of what happens to the poor does matter. And again, it's probably one of those areas where people are building on a Christian foundation even if they don't realise that's what they're actually doing, because it flows out of stuff like human beings made in God's image. It flows out of the principles in Deuteronomy. To be slightly more contentious, it is worth us noting that we are, is it still the sixth biggest economy in the world? We are vastly wealthy as a country. I have to be honest, it did disappoint me when this government cut international aid recently. I think that's quite a difficult thing to defend when we're appallingly wealthy as a country, when actually there are those who are poor and needy around the place. A concern for the poor and the needy does seem to matter. And I think when Christians engage in politics and cast votes and so on, amongst the vast plethora of issues that you want to consider, how does this party care for the poor is an issue that should feature in Christians' minds as they vote. And that's the most politics I think I've ever done in a sermon. Because I do think the main trajectory is across to the church. You know, we are the people of God. And as you get into the New Testament, it is quite evident that the church regards this as applying to them. Because what the early church managed to do is they do manage to create the situation that should have existed within the Promised Land. Acts chapter 4, verse 34, talking about the early church, there was no needy person among them. If you like, within the church, they managed to make poverty history in the early church. There was no needy person among them. And they did that, of course, without a welfare state. How did they do it? People sold land and houses. And again, you think, gosh, that's pretty remarkable, isn't it? You know, it's almost as remarkable as offering a loan in the sixth year when you know you're not going to get it back. Okay, that person is in desperate need within the church. Actually, their need matters more than I have this extra land. Their need matters more than my house is nice. It's the example of open-handed generosity, such that there ends up being no needy person among them. John Owen was Vice Chancellor of Oxford University back in the 17th century, puts it like this, Christ is glorified and the gospel is honoured when we care for the poor. And that was certainly the case in ancient society. You find, again, it written by those who hate Christians around the second century, that one of the reasons actually the church seems to be having an impact in ancient society is they care for the poor. And again, in a situation where there's no welfare state, it was striking. Gosh, where's those poor people? Who's care? Oh, it's these irritating Christians. Yeah, it's, I think, probably one of the reasons the gospel spreads in the early years is because Christians become known for this. If you like, living out the vision for the promised land becomes the experience within the church. But just lastly, before we perhaps talk and pray, how do you motivate yourself for this? Because what we've seen persistently in Deuteronomy 15 onwards is the concern that we have is not what's good for me, but what's good for that person in need. How do you motivate yourself for that? How do you motivate yourself such that, where some of us will be in the position where perhaps as students, we're not currently thinking, I have a vast amount of surplus income to distribute, but how do I begin to set ambitions such that when I do, these are going to be my concerns rather than how do I establish my house and have more land? How do you motivate yourself to get into that position? Well, can I say there are two main motivations in this section? One is a challenge and one's an encouragement. The challenge is this in Deuteronomy 15. Do you notice, remember that sort of giving them the loan in the sixth year? And did you notice it, verse 9? Be careful not to harbour this wicked thought, I'm not going to get my money back. I find that really striking. To me, it seems an eminently reasonable thought. You know, 6 years, I'm not going to get my money back. That seems eminently reasonable, and Moses says it's wicked. It's quite striking, isn't it? It's saying, you know, actually to prefer your own comfort to the needs of the poor is a wicked thought. And verse 9, chapter 15, they may then appeal to the Lord against you, and you will be found guilty of sin. In other words, the challenge of Deuteronomy 15 is basically this: to prefer our own material comfort and to ignore the needs of the poor, the Bible says, is sin. It is that striking, actually. To prefer our own comfort and ignore the needs of the poor, the Bible regards as sinful. I find that quite challenging, actually, because it kind of feels, well, it doesn't feel like the worst of sins, but that's why we need to think about this issue of what we do with our money, because the Bible has stuff to say about it. But the second motivation is this, and it's the motivation you get in verse 14 and 15 of chapter 15. Give to them as the Lord your God has blessed you. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. That is why I'm giving you this command today. You can you imagine, and you find this, don't you, throughout Deuteronomy, how God's people are called consciously to remember their story. Why should I give to that poor person? Because, gosh, I was a slave in Egypt. I had nothing. Absolutely nothing I had until God intervened and rescued us and took us into this land where he has blessed us. And, gosh, if God has blessed me like this, well, surely I can give. I had nothing. God's given me everything. Therefore, that's what enables me to be liberal and open-handed. Of course, for us, it's even clearer. You know, the Christian story is this: we were slaves and now we're not. Slaves not in Egypt, but slaves to sin and death and hell. We were slaves and now we're not. Because the Lord Jesus has rescued us and given us every spiritual blessing in Christ. And even the material resources we have, I think you did harvest earlier, even the material resources we have, all of those are a gift from God. So do you see, in a sense, how strange it is when a Christian is mean-spirited? How inconsistent it is? Freely we've received, freely we give. Now, can I say, I don't feel I need to push that hard, in as much as I've been around the church long enough to know there is generosity in terms of time and finance all over the place. You know, I know there's been provision for those in need. But can I say, if you like, the Christian priority is not growth, growth, growth. The Christian priority is generosity, generosity, generosity. That's the essence of this. What's the Christian perspective on money? Generosity, generosity, generosity. As I don't think I need to push it hard, knowing most of you well, but just, I suppose, the question we need to go away with is this. As I think about my attitude towards money and those in need, what adjective would I use to describe myself? Slightly tight? Shrewd? Even wise? Or generous? That's cool. Generosity, generosity, generosity. Why don't we go back into our groups and just pray for 3 or 4 minutes, just praying that maybe you want to give thanks to the Lord's generosity to us, and then we'll sing a final song, and I'll explain why we're going to sing it in a minute. Go for it.